Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca Mesut Ozil. Alexis en el descuento ha marcado el Arsenal, como viene siendo habitual esta temporada. Gol de Alexis, 1-0 Arsenal.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always with James from Gunnerblog. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
What a weekend.
What a weekend. It's good to talk to you. I feel like because we do this podcast, I have to sort of, you know, try and not communicate with you in the hours before, the days before, so that we have stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
But after a game, I sometimes want to spill it. So I've been holding quite a lot back, and it's a relief to finally be on this podcast and let go a bit.
Like a giant pimple that you're able to squeeze.
It's absolutely like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not quite sure where to start. I think we need to compartmentalize this whole thing a little bit first. So I reckon we should start with the game and what we thought of that, and then we can go on and discuss all the other things which have been borne out because of what happened. So 3-0 down at halftime to Stoke.
Yeah.
And in a season where, you know, I've often said, I think we've often said on this podcast, you just never know what might happen. That's within the realm of you never know what might happen, in the sense that, you know, you could find £5,000 on the street and you could be 3-0 down to Stoke at halftime. It felt a little bit surreal, not unexpected and not a shock, but still kind of surreal because it's Stoke.
It was odd. I mean, I guess when the team sheet came out, I felt the writing was, you know, if not on the wall, certainly someone had a pencil stood very near a wall.
They'd stenciled it out.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
They definitely made provision for it. And, the back five looked, you know, raw, because Hector Bellerin was in there, Callum Chambers was in there, Emiliano Martinez, and I did fear for them slightly, and for those fears to be realised quite so quickly.
Mm.
What was it, 20 seconds, something like that?
25 seconds, I believe, when Peter Crouch spindled the ball over the line with his ridiculous stork legs.
Yeah. And I think the first half was one of the worst defensive performances I've seen from Arsenal. A lot of people have said to me, oh, but how can you say that? There have been so many. But for me, I think the calibre of the opposition, you know, at least when you're getting battered by Liverpool and Chelsea and even Manchester United, you can say, well, they've got some great attacking players. I'm not sure the same is true of Stoke. They're sort of middling team, really.
Yeah.
And we made them look a lot better than they are. And that was, you know, unforgivable. I mean, the amount of errors that went into all three of the goals was unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, did we come to any kind of conclusion as to why Per Mertesacker moves from the right centre-back to the left centre-back position to accommodate Callum Chambers, when Callum Chambers could, to my mind, just as easily play left centre-back as right centre-back? I don't quite understand that.
No, because Callum Chambers hasn't got an established way of playing at centre-half. I was thinking about it yesterday. I think Nacho Monreal has probably played more games as a centre-back than Callum Chambers has now at the top level.
Yeah.
So it sort of seems odd to build around him. The logical thing to me seems to be to keep Mertesacker where he's happy and let him, you know, help Chambers through the game.
Yeah, it was like that. Wasn't there a game when could have been Bellerin came on or something, and pretty much every member of the back four had to shift one space to the the left, I think it was. Mm. You know, it just makes more sense to me to keep players in the positions they're most naturally suited to. But I think that's kind of a small issue overall. You know,
it does annoy me though, because we did it at Everton with Mertesacker on the left of Chambers, and it was a bit of a disaster then as well.
Yeah.
And
I mean, there must be some kind of logic to it. We just don't know what it is.
It will probably be that Chambers has played most of his games at right back, and so Wenger effectively feels he's more comfortable, you know, on that half of the field. I imagine that will be the core of it. But it's interesting when you think about some of Chambers' best performances at centre half. The Community Shield, for example, the opening day of the season, they came alongside Laurent Koscielny rather than Per Mertesacker.
Yeah,
that seems a more natural and effective partnership.
Yeah,
of the three centre backs we've got.
So look, 3-0 down, and you're looking at it going, fucking fuck, fuck. There was a halftime change. Hector Bellerin came off. Matthew Flamini moved to right back. I mean, he had to do something to try and work it out. And there were a couple of moments, I think, in the second half where we looked, you know, a bit more in the game. Alexis hugely unlucky with a brilliant run, and that finish that came back off the post, that would have been one of the goals of the season, I think. Do we have a little bit more understanding of how Alexis missed his chance as opposed to Olivier Giroud missing his? Because at least Alexis had run from halfway and sprinted through the defence, and if there was a tiredness to his finish, it's vaguely understandable, whereas Giroud heading wide 1-0, that did my head in.
Yeah, I mean, of course Alexis should have scored. I'm sure he would have felt the same himself. But I think generally fans are more forgiving of a player when they've created the chance entirely for themselves. You know, it's kind of like, well, fair enough, you know, you started in a position where no one expected anything. You should have scored once you got there, but at least you generated that opportunity individually. With Giroud, it was a chance that was put on a plate for him, really, by a great cross from Hector Bellerin, who did well just to keep the ball in play. And that's something that we've seen before from Giroud. You know, he can be a little bit less clinical than we'd like. And it's frustrating because, obviously, on those things, games hinge entirely, don't they? You know, goals at that stage of a game can completely transform the complexion. So,
yeah,
a lot of what ifs, I guess, about that chance.
Yeah. Two goals then. Well, I mean, that whole thing when we were nearly 4-0 down, and then all of a sudden we're 3-2 in the space of about, what, 5 minutes?
Yeah.
That was bizarre.
That was bizarre, and I think it probably should have been 4, looking at the replay.
Yeah, I mean, if that goal had been disallowed, if we'd scored that and the goal had been disallowed, I'd have been very,
furious,
very annoyed. The referee we might touch on in a few minutes as a separate thing.
I think so, yeah.
What did you make of the second yellow card for Callum Chambers?
It's harsh, isn't it? Two fouls, and I think it's harsh in context. I think in a very clean game, you know, for him to pick up bookings for those things might not have seemed quite so odd, but it's what was going on across the whole pitch that wasn't being punished that made his punishment stand out. If you see what Peter Crouch was doing to the centre-halves, if you see what Jonathan Walters was doing to... Sorry, Charlie Adam, I confused these Orcs. They are sort of similar in stature and ugliness. Was doing to Alexis Sanchez. That's what makes Chambers' sending off particularly galling. I think it was very harsh indeed.
Okay, so we're on the referee now, and you know, as a caveat, neither of us are suggesting that the reason we lost the game was because of the referee.
No.
That doesn't mean that we can't point out the fact that he is a fucking useless cunt. I don't think there's any problem with that. How on earth can a referee look at Peter Crouch, stick his arm straight into Chambers' face, and go over and give him a warning? And then he did it like minutes into the second half on Mertesacker and rightly got a yellow card, but that should have been a red card. The Charlie Adam incident is just unbelievable. Like, how can you put a player in a chokehold and not get sent off?
I agree.
The linesman is looking right at it.
It's bizarre. And so my initial thing is to think, oh, well, was the referee just going with the home side? But then you look at that fourth goal, and actually it's not, the linesman doesn't flag at all. It's the referee who disallows it. So the guy was just clueless, I think. It was a really poor performance from the official. Really poor. But I suppose, as you said, that's not the reason that we lost. I mean, there was this kind of second half fight back. Did you feel before the sending off that we might go on and do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought at 3-2, you know, having come back, like we talked about with the Giroud thing, that the goals change the momentum of a game. That Stoke are 3-0 up and cruising, and we know what it's like to be like 3-2, and then hang on a minute, you gotta hang on for another 20 minutes, because there were 20 minutes, including injury time there, and the red card obviously made that very, very difficult, almost impossible for us to make the comeback. So, you know, it genuinely wouldn't have surprised me if we'd stayed with 11 men and managed to nick something from that game. Which isn't to say that it wouldn't have done much more than paper over some of the first half cracks, but I think we were slightly unlucky in that regard, but only in that regard, because the rest of the performance is pretty much indefensible because of the way we defended. And look, it ultimately, for me, comes back all the way to the summer and all the way to the recruitment and the lack of recruitment in the defensive areas, that you can look at pretty much every bad result we've had this season and put it down to the fact that we just don't have enough defenders.
Yeah, because I talked about the starting 11 looking a little bit worrying, but the reality is that there was no choice, was there?
No, Koscielny, I mean,
couldn't play, and Morale couldn't play. That's all we had, pretty much.
Mm.
And it is a little bit boring to constantly go back to the summer transfer window, but that's the answer, isn't it? We just didn't do enough.
Yeah, it is. So look, then, okay, that frustration obviously manifested itself in many ways. Mm. You know, there were people inside the ground talking about how when the team was going off at halftime, they were getting plenty of stick from the fans. And I don't think anybody in that context has any real issue with that. It's inside the ground. People have paid their money. The team has played abysmally. The manager hasn't done a great deal about it. You know, the problems that we had on the pitch come back to the frustrations that people have with the manager in the first place. So blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, there was that video capture as the team were getting onto the train. Well, I mean, I think as I said in the blog today, booing isn't necessary. I don't see that as abuse.
Right? No, I didn't see the banner at West Brom as abuse personally either.
But perhaps then it crosses a line where it becomes personal, or people are sort of hurling invective at the manager, and on a basic, very basic human level, you know, I don't like to see that. And whatever you think about the manager, he's still somebody I've got a great deal of respect for. He's done brilliant things for Arsenal Football Club. If we're falling below the standards that we expect, it's because he created those standards on a consistent basis. You know, we've never had this period of sustained consistency at that end of the table. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword very much in that regard. I mean, what did you think of the reaction in that sense?
The video I thought was really quite distressing, I suppose, because as you say, we've all got a great deal of, well, not we've all, but a lot of us still have a great deal of admiration for Arsene Wenger, and a great deal of affection, even if you don't necessarily believe he's the right man for the job moving forward. I think I've said many times those things aren't mutually exclusive. And I think it felt to me like it did cross a line. Perhaps it was because it was outside of the ground. I don't know. It feels like within the context of a football stadium, certain things are permissible that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be taken into the street. I mean, I feel like it's one step removed now from someone going up to Arsene Wenger and screaming in his face when he's in a restaurant with his family. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You worry about how far that will go. And it's unpleasant. And I think what's maybe most troubling is that a lot of the people who really lay into Arsenal often say, well, it's because they see Arsenal as something bigger than one manager. You know, they're about Arsenal rather than Arsene. And I think if you are about Arsenal, then the values inherent in that should be upheld to an extent. And it felt a very unclassy way to go about our business. It was, yeah, upsetting, I thought.
Is there not this, is this Arsenal class thing not just some kind of a construct that doesn't necessarily exist? No, but I mean, I'm being deadly serious because,
yeah,
you know, it's a football club. Where is the Arsenal class when it comes to putting up prices of the tickets by 3%? What's particularly classy about that? And with any football support, and because of the nature of football and the people that go to football, you've got really great people and you've got some people that aren't so great. That's true of every single football club. So, I think sometimes he's, you know, this thing about this is not Arsenal class. I don't necessarily understand it.
Well, I'm not trying to put us on a pedestal above other clubs. You know, I'm not into that whole Barcelona more than a club thing. I just think that any club would be a little bit disappointed to see someone behaving quite so boorishly among their supporters.
Sure, I get that, but I don't understand why it's like it's unexpected in a way that, oh my God, I didn't think Arsenal fans were capable of this.
Sure. How many people are we talking about as well here?
Well, that's very true. That's very true. But I mean, what do you think Arsene Wenger's reaction to this is going to be? Because look, one of the things that he says all the time is that he's been a football manager for 30 years. You know, do you not think I know what I'm doing after 30 years of being in football? So he knows football. He knows the game. He knows that when things go well, that he's the man, that he's going to get the praise. And he knows fine well that when things aren't going well, that he is going to be the subject of criticism. He knows particularly now that he is going to be the brunt of criticism because of this. People have become maybe a little tired of the
status quo.
Yeah, the status quo, the consistency. Fourth isn't enough for people. Even when you step back and look at that objectively against the opposition and against, you know, people are just a bit, it feels a bit stale. So he must know that when things like the Stoke performance happen, and the reasons for that Stoke performance, which you go back to, the not buying defenders, etc., etc., he cannot be in any way surprised that some people will react in a hugely negative way. Now, I'm all for, you know, criticism is absolutely fine. I don't believe in venturing over the line into that kind of abuse. But he can't be surprised that some people will have gone there. And I don't think for one second that Arsene Wenger is sitting at London Colney this morning in a dark room, rocking back and forward, wondering why people don't love him, you know?
No, I don't either. I really don't.
I think if anything, it will just kind of redouble his efforts. Now, the question is whether or not you think his efforts are good enough or whether he's capable of lifting things up to a sufficient degree. But I don't think it's gonna damage him in a huge way.
I mean, the other thing is, like, this is the first time it's been captured on camera, but is that really the first time that's ever happened in Arsene Wenger's tenure? I sincerely doubt it.
That's a, you know, yeah, exactly.
If you think about some of the results we've had, Chelsea, man, you know, the 8-2, the thrashing at Liverpool, I would be staggered if he hasn't encountered that kind of reaction before.
Of course, but yeah, I think you're right that this is the first time it's been made public or made viral in a way, and that has perhaps given it a bit of a different spin. You know?
I think maybe what's one of the reasons I find it particularly depressing is actually kind of, in some ways it's less about the content but more about the consequence in terms of these massive divisions that exist between Arsenal fans and that dialogue we see played out online. You know, I feel like the supporter base, the cracks are developing into ravines, really.
Mm.
And it's just, it feels like a very unpleasant time.
Yeah,
to me at least.
Yeah, it feels unhealthy. That's the dog. Yeah, that's probably the postman arriving. I mean, I think it is. It's a really, really unhealthy situation because, you know, we had supposedly got to a point where we've won a trophy. We've, in the early part of the summer, people are going, what is Arsene Wenger doing? He's lying on the beach. And then all of a sudden it's, whoa, Arsene Wenger is the man because he's brought us Alexis. He's brought us Ospina. We've got Debuchy in to replace Sanya. Good early summer signs. Ooh, Callum Chambers. And it had built to a point where you're thinking, right, he is really, really going for it in terms of what we're going to do this season. And it's fallen way short of what people expected.
But do you think, for me, the positive moments just don't seem to sustain at all? It feels like faith in the manager is damaged to such an extent that he is really struggling to buy any time.
Swimming against the tide.
Constantly. So he wins the FA Cup, but that doesn't seem to generate any long-term credit. You know, within a few months, people call him for his head. He wins three games on the spin in the last couple of weeks, and now one defeat, and the vitriol is there just as much as ever. I'm not necessarily criticising people for that, but I'm saying the problem for the manager is that it feels like even when he gets on a good run, he's one bad thing away from the tide turning again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the reality of the situation, you know, and I think you're right when you talk about the cracks that exist within the fan base, that there tends to be extremes at both ends, right? So there's people who think the manager can still do no wrong, and there's people who think that the manager is the worst person in the world ever. And those positions are becoming more and more entrenched. I don't know if you saw, but I think I tweeted something or retweeted something on Saturday, a young lady who was talking about how she's never going to go to an away game again because she was afraid because fans were fighting with each other, literally kicking the shit out of each other outside the Britannia Stadium. And that, you know, when it comes to that, your fans are the same club. When you can't even respect another person's point of view to the extent that you're actually fighting them, physically fighting people, that is a really unhealthy situation. It's
crazy. I mean, it's awful, and it's been going on for a little while now. If you listen to people who've been going to away games regularly, but I think it's getting worse and worse. I think what's interesting though is to ask why. Why is this happening? Is it something to do with our club? Is it something to do with the way that the fans feel that they're in such a position of, I don't know, sort of a purgatorial position whereby they feel nothing will change without intervention, that is pushing people to such extreme stances and extreme measures?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think I have a question marked here for our question section, but I think it works now. I'm just going to find it here, and it comes from, oh shit, I'm sorry, it's Aurelien Rougemont. And the question is, does the board need to accept some responsibility for fans' feelings towards Arsene Wenger? Ticket prices, empty promises, etc., etc. So, I mean, Wenger is obviously the lightning rod, but are there other issues which are informing the way that people feel about him? Like, I mean, would people be less fucked off if they hadn't had a 3% pay rise or a ticket rise in the summer?
Maybe.
Would they be less fucked off if there was a board with genuine football knowledge who could influence the manager in a way?
Yeah.
That, you know, when that whole Sir Chips thing that, if he's got a plan, we back him. And if he doesn't have a plan, well, you know, we just leave him be.
I actually think that even if we had a board who had the balls to sort of, who people believed had the balls to sack a manager, I actually think it would take some of the pressure off the manager. I think that part of the problem is that people are so convinced that the board will never sack him that they almost feel the onus is on the fans to voice their discontent because they feel there's no repercussions or judgment from that top level. I think that that's part of the problem, to be honest.
Yeah.
But one thing I think is interesting is if you ask yourself, who at Arsenal cares about winning? Is it the board or is it the manager? Who cares more about winning the Premier League? I think it's definitely Arsene Wenger rather than Stan Kroenke or Kroenke or whatever
you
want to call
it. I would agree with that completely.
No one at Arsenal wants to win more than Arsene Wenger. That is, I think, fact. You know, for all the criticism of him, you cannot doubt his intention.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The issue then becomes one of competence or ability.
Of course, yeah, and that's separate, I think.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, in terms of if you had to pick sides between the board and between Arsenal, if what we all want is to win, the one who it allies most closely with that is the manager in terms of his ambition and you know, what he wants to do. He might not always go about it the right way. We might not agree with the way he goes about it, but you can't really question what he wants at the end of it. Whereas with the board, I'd suspect that they're, you know, winning was a nice bonus, but if the business is still turning over at a successful rate, it's not such a problem.
And then you come to the issue of, you know, if it does end or when it ends for Arsene Wenger, that you're looking at these people who nobody really has any great confidence in or trust in, in terms of how they run the club from a footballing point of view, because I don't know that anybody would look at Arsenal and say, okay, that appears to be a very well-run business, very slickly run outfit in terms of, you know, the money that they generate and how they generate, et cetera, et cetera. But from a football point of view, who's picking the manager? Who's who does that? A team of consultants? That's what'll happen. They'll get some consultancy firm in and they'll, you know, buzzword this and put together, you know, that's how it'll happen, rather than a football club with the football knowledge to appoint the right football man. So I think, you know, there's a weird, yeah, I think you're right, there's a weird kind of dichotomy there between, you know, the manager and the board, and, you know, it's all part of the same big thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that is a concern, obviously, because it, you know, even with, people will cite the David Moyes example, but credit Manchester United. When David Moyes went wrong, they behaved like a big club. They did what they had to do. They sacked him. They brought in a massive manager and spent about 200 million quid. I feel like if we appointed David Moyes, we'd probably stick with him.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If we had appointed David Moyes, he'd probably still be in charge at Arsenal.
Yeah.
And that's the worrying thing, is that mentality there at board level.
Mm.
I don't know. Just to bring it back to the manager, what did you make of his comments after the game?
I mean, I think he was critical of the defence, and he said that we were too soft defensively, which is right. But, you know, what struck me was the bit where he said there were a lot of positives.
That's why I mention it.
To me, that just was unnecessary. There was no need to say that. Even if, you know, we know he's not a guy who's going to come out and say, that was terrible, we're terrible, we shouldn't be so terrible, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he'll be critical in his way, you know, we were soft defensively, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no need to say that there were a lot of positives, because all that does is wind people up. Mm. You know, there's, what positives? Really? So some people say Santi Cazorla scored a goal. It was a penalty. Most of us could score a penalty. Aaron Ramsey got a goal. Well, I mean, it wasn't even from the corner. The corner was cleared. I mean, it was a grand hit by Ramsey. But, you know, is that a positive on a day in which so much else went wrong? You know, I think there were just... I think it was a game where all the shortcomings that we've got, for all the reasons that we've touched on, were exposed. And I don't see any need to try and find positives in that. Even if what he's saying is very much, what he says in public always is quite careful, I think, because he wants to try and promote a positive outlook and keep the players up and alive and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, sometimes just hold your hands up and say, look, that was bad.
Yeah, I wrote about this on my blog. I mean, I suspect Arsene is kind of too big at Arsenal to take advice from any kind of PR person. I'm not even sure there is someone who would sort of manage his communications in that way, but I do feel that sometimes it would actually do him some favours just to be a bit more honest about what happened. I think that I understand why he chooses to sort of put the positive spin on things, but I think that all that does is infuriate supporters now. Mm. He doesn't care about that, but I just think that if someone wanted to at the club, you know, try and protect the manager a bit more, they might say, look, on this one, just sort of hold your hands up, because I think it would people would appreciate the honesty. Mm. I think that although people understand the reasons that he gives the answers he does, I think it's sort of starting to grate with a lot of fans now.
All right, well, look, I suppose the other big issue that we have as we head towards tomorrow in the Champions League is whether or not Joel Campbell got out.
I know. I mean, I know we're all worried about it. I've written a lot of letters to Amnesty trying to get him free.
He must have heard that. Get out while you still can, Joel. Run for your life! He must have just like, oh, shit, I better not get on the train. I'll scamper across the fields to freedom.
Yeah,
to live life.
If you look in the corner of that YouTube video, you can actually, while Arsene Wenger walks across the screen, in the background, Joel Campbell is stealthily crawling into the toilet to hide.
Yeah.
Do anything but get on that train back to London Colney and his multi-million pound contract with Arsenal.
Yeah.
the guy has got to break free. Have to say, it was quite funny seeing Joel Campbell warm up in his kit for fully, I think, 10 minutes before he came on at Stoke.
What was that about? I didn't get that because, they cut to him on the sideline from the TV and it's like, here's Joel Campbell, he's about to come on. And then he threw him on in the 92nd. In a way, it almost felt pointed.
Yeah, he was making an example of him.
It was like, yeah, go get ready there, and then I'm going to throw you on for 3 minutes when you can.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Have absolutely no impact at all when, if he'd thrown him on in the 82nd minute with the 6 minutes of injury time that there were, the guy had close to 15 minutes.
I have to say, the use of Joel Campbell, I almost feel like Wenger's bringing him on to just give him appearances so that his appearance record says he played six times before January, so he can say, well, look, he played six times. I mean, they are redundant, the appearances he's making, aren't they? They're cameos in the true sense.
Maybe he does need to get out while he still can, right?
Yeah. Run, Joel, run.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with your questions in part two right after this. Welcome back to this cheery Laugh a Minute Arsecast Extra. And now is the time where we take your questions sent to us by you, obviously, on Twitter, to Gunnerblog and at Arseblog. And the first question today comes from Shivam Khanna, and that's at ShivKhanna14. And he said, assuming we had signed a centre-back in a DM and the results were exactly the same, how different would reactions be?
That is a great question. I think that's a really good question. Because if you talk to people who are vehemently against Arsene Wenger, that's the first thing they'll say. He didn't strengthen the requisite amount in the summer. I suspect that the reaction would be as bad. Because I think people would say, look at the squad he's got, and he's not getting the best out of it. Which there is a certain element of this season already. But I think because of what we talked about earlier, that such thin patience, so little patience before the anger rises, that I think that it might be just as tricky. What about you?
Yeah, that's kind of what I think. That there's an ability, not just with Arsenal fans, but with football fans in general, to shift the goalposts all over the place simply because it's possible to do that, and they can do it in such a way that it backs up what they think already. So the issue is that, yes, we didn't get enough central defenders, and that's an issue, and maybe we should have got ourselves a midfield linchpin. However, if the results were the same, the blame would be still on Arsene Wenger, and it would be for another reason. It would be because injuries, or because Giroud is shit, or because Welbeck is this, or because Ramsey is that. It would shift in that regard. So I think there might have been a little bit more patience, a little bit, but generally speaking, I think it would have been the same. However, I think it would also have been easier not to counter the criticism, but to say, well, look, we bought all these players, so it's not an issue of personnel or lack of personnel. Then it becomes perhaps more an issue for the manager because he's the one that's putting his team out. So,
I mean, I think the goalposts have already shifted. The goalposts for a long time were win a trophy. The goalposts were start buying marquee players. And he has done those things.
Yeah.
And I think that what that shows is that I don't think people are quite honest enough about what it is that frustrates them about the manager. I think a lot of it is just to do with a kind of boredom, a kind of, long-term frustration, and a case of familiarity breeding contempt.
Mm.
And I think that the reasons would change, the named reasons would change, but that will not go away now. You know, there's just a certain degree to which I think only winning the Premier League can kind of save Arsene Wenger from the contempt of a certain portion of the fan base. I think that, yeah, it's a weird one, but I had something else to say and it's completely gone.
Yeah, so. Well, I wouldn't worry about it. I do know what you mean, though, that, like we said earlier, he's swimming against the tide and he's running up a down escalator, kind of.
Yeah, it's exactly that.
Yeah,
it's
all exactly right. That. Go
Let's
on,
another
then.
Question.
Why not?
Another cheery one. Ooh, this one is from... don't know, actually. Sorry, this is awful presenting.
It really is. It's appalling.
Thank you. This is from Cavetastic. He asks, do you think Arsene isn't telling his team how to defend, or are they just ignoring him?
I don't know why they would just ignore him. I think we know that defensive coaching has never been his forte.
Mm.
But he does have Steve Bould there, and he does have Neil Banfield, and he does have Boro Primorac, all of whom are experienced coaches, all of whom have a certain amount of work to do on the training ground. I just think that the inability to field a consistent quality back four or five has been a real problem. That last season when we had Sanya, Mertesacker, Kassiani, Gibbs and Chesney behind them, we've a goalkeeper that shares the golden fist, we've got a load of clean sheets, we've got apart from those crazy days when things went really wrong, a team that looked like it could get a one or two goal lead and hang on to it and not go crazy. But again, we come back to just not being able to A, feel that consistent back four, and B, we don't have the ability to replace key components of it when they go missing through injury or suspension or whatever it might be. I don't think there's a situation where the team are just ignoring him. I mean, if you look at the third Stoke goal, there's a willingness to defend that. You know, you could see players really, really trying to defend the corner. The problem was three or four of them went to contest a ball with a 6'8" bloke, and he just headed it down. And because there was three or four of them there, Walters was left unmarked.
I mean, that was chaos, though, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
that's what it is. It's panic, it's chaos, it's lack of organisation. And that is maybe something that you need to look at on pitch to find a solution for that. But look, I don't know.
Do we know that Steve Bould is a good defensive coach?
I don't know what we know about Steve Bould. We really don't know anything about him. In terms of the impact that he has, I mean, there was a suggestion, wasn't there, that, a couple of seasons ago that he was allowed work with the defence and all of a sudden we started getting clean sheets, and then Arsene Wenger didn't like that for some reason.
He hated it. He hated having clean sheets.
How dare they? How dare they not concede goals? You know, I never understood that kind of thing.
He was jealous, though. He was jealous of all the clean sheets.
But he's a very passive kind of a guy, isn't he? He appears to be. I'm sure on the training ground he's got a lot to say, but during games, he's not like Pat Rice. Pat Rice was on his feet and in the technical area and shouting and screaming at players, and Steve Bould doesn't.
No, I think we're all a bit guilty of thinking about it rather simplistically. I think there's an assumption that the type of guy someone is as a player is the type of coach they are.
Yeah, but even as a player, Steve Bould, and I was just discussing this with West Antone last week, that even as a player, he wasn't the gobby one. He wasn't. Mm. He just kind of was, a silent, murderous, kick-you-up-in-the-air assassin. That's what he did. He was a fucking brilliant defender. I loved him. But, you know, he wasn't the vocal leader because he had Tony Adams alongside him. He had Keown there sometimes. You know, you have Dixon and Winterburn either side of you. He didn't need to do any of that. He knew what he had to do, and that was go around and tackle the shite out of people and fucking, you know, that was his job.
That's true, but I also think, you know, Roberto Mancini was an attacker of great flair, but his sides play a type of cautious defensive football. You know, for all we know, Steve Bould's Arsenal under 18 team was like the Newcastle of the, you know, mid 90s, the great entertainers. They might be like the very much like the modern Arsenal first team.
Mm.
I think that sometimes, yeah, we hope for things from Steve Bould that might not necessarily be justified.
Yeah.
As for, yeah, I mean, the just that corner thing really annoyed me because we must have known there was a good chance Stoke would use Peter Crouch against us. They're not idiots, as much as we might dislike them. And it felt like there wasn't necessarily a plan to deal with that at all.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's always irritating.
All right, here's a question. This comes from Selbridge Gooner, and he wants to know, how should fans express an opinion that Arsene Wenger should step down without disrespecting the best manager in our history? So, yeah, that's a really tricky one.
I had that question from a few other people as well. I think Wesley MC UK asked, and a couple of others. Sorry for not mentioning. It's really difficult, isn't it? I mean, so we spoke about the banner, was it just last week, I think? And I think we were both of a mind that was kind of, if a bit uncomfortable, sort of acceptable. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's ways and means of communicating, I guess. And yeah, I mean, it was the message was fairly direct and clear.
I think the only, I don't know where the line is. I don't know really what the end game is. Like, is the idea of these protests or these public shows of frustration that it will result in Arsene Wenger being sacked?
Well, or that he might resign, because I think there's far more chance of him resigning than there is
Absolutely.
Of him being sacked, right? That would be my thinking on it. So I wonder, is the desire to make the protests or to make his life as uncomfortable as possible so that he might consider that? Because I don't see the board acting on it.
No, I think so. Maybe it's about showing him, you know, Wenger, I think, has said in the past, if people don't want me here, do you know what I mean? I won't stay.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a sense of, oh, well, we must, you know, communicate that to him somehow. As for the right way to go about it, I don't know. I think is the wrong way is stuff that occurs outside a football ground. I think that's where my line is, in terms of what I find palatable. What about you?
In what sense? I mean, how do fans express their opinion? Or how should they?
How should they? How should they is the question, isn't it?
How can, let's say, wow, who was screaming?
I don't know.
Did you hear that?
I think it's in your head. The voices are back.
Hang on. There's definitely somebody screaming.
But if something bad has happened, this has turned into serial.
Yeah.
This could be a really disturbing episode of the podcast.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay here.
You yeah.
Hold the fort.
I think it was, yeah, somebody outside my house screaming.
Mm.
And they are doing some work on a house across the road, and I'm hoping that there hasn't been an angle grinding accident of some kind.
Jesus. I mean, this has been a distressing episode of the podcast, but I mean, this is a turn for the worse, definitely.
It really has. Maybe it's actually just Joel Campbell scorching towards freedom, running down my road. I'm free at last! Anyway,
well, Dublin is the natural destination.
Well, yeah, exactly. He could walk down the street completely unhindered here. No one would recognise him.
It'd be like the Arsenal training ground.
Yeah.
were we talking about?
We were talking about how fans should express their opinion.
How so fans
how can, on an individual basis, you know, everyone has the ability to write a letter, for example, to the club, whether it gets to Arsene Wenger or not, whether they want to address it to Arsene Wenger. People have their social media platforms. Some people can use their own websites, podcasts to express their opinion. But as a collective,
self-important wankers.
Yes, that they are, and we all are. But how can a collective express their opinion other than through what many people will see as kind of unseemly behavior. And we've touched on it. I don't think booing is anything other than a part and parcel of how large crowds of people react to things. So whether it's at a politician or a football match or a bad play, or if you see Phil Collins walking down the street, what do? You boo, right? So, I mean, I think that people are going to react to what happens as and when it happens. And that obviously dictates the level of the reaction. I don't know. I don't know if there's a right way or a wrong way or a way for it to be done that's always respectful or anything like that. I just don't know if that's possible, just by the very nature of the situation.
Yeah. Also, this thing of respect, I mean, I'm not sure how long that will last. You know, it's that thing of, well, I respect you, but I want you to be sacked, or I want you to resign. It's like there is an inherent contradiction there, isn't there? And
yeah,
it's a difficult balance to achieve.
It's like saying, with all due respect, that means I think you're a wanker.
Yeah,
but
something awful is coming.
Yeah.
And I think there is a measure of that in terms of, in these issues.
Mm.
It's a really difficult question, that. The only thing the board will listen to, for what it's worth, I think, is financial stuff. So ticket sales, basically.
Yeah, that if they start seeing huge swathes of tickets being unsold, then that, I think, will obviously have an impact. But until then, I don't see it. So I don't know. It's a great question, but difficult.
I've got a question.
Go on.
Right. I've got a question. My question is, do you think there's any point at which the divisiveness of the manager becomes in itself the problem? Do you think there's any point at which the board would go, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but ripping our club apart to an extent?
I think it's ultimately dictated by what's happening on the pitch. In the sense that if things get really, really bad on the pitch, that divisiveness will grow, right? It will. I mean, if we have a string of bad results and we're mid-table, then, you know, all of a sudden the divisiveness might, in a way, unite people, because it gets to a point where it becomes impossible to defend. Do you know what I mean? That if it gets really bad, then I think that the groundswell of opinion that more moderate people, moderate is the wrong word, I'm sorry, but people who are still inclined to think that Arsene Wenger is the right man will change their mind about that. That if it all comes down to what happens on the pitch. And as long as things are relatively okay on the pitch in terms of results and where we are in the table and everything else, then I think they'll live with it. But until such time as it becomes really, really, really bad, nothing will happen.
Mm.
That's what I think.
Another question?
Yeah.
Okay, this one comes from Johnny Page. I really like his name. I don't know why. I think
Johnny
it's
Page.
It feels like a cross between Johnny Cash and Jimmy Page or something. I don't know. He seems like a cool guy.
Right.
He asks,
should ask him out for tea.
Consider it asked, Johnny. Tweet me. Even with Cosback, that's Lawrence Shelley.
I was wondering who the hell Cosback was. What's a Cosback?
Exactly. he's nice, Johnny, but he's not perfect. Do you think we need an upgrade over Mertesacker as centre-back? I feel like he's regressed quickly.
I think that we need a centre-half that is as good or better than either of Koscielny or Mertesacker. That's what I think. I think partnerships are important, and I think the Koscielny-Mertesacker partnership is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was borne out by a couple of the recent results, that as soon as Koscielny's back in the side, we look a lot better defensively. Mertesacker looks a lot better defensively. I think in a way also, Aaron Ramsey is a better player when Mikel Arteta is in the team.
Mm-hmm.
I think those partnerships exist in football. But, you know, I think if you're going to go and buy a centre-half, you should go and buy... There's the lorry. You've got to go and buy the best player that you can possibly get. So, yeah, I mean, look, if we can upgrade on any player in the squad, I think we should do that. But I also think that people are very quick to write off players and not be in any way forgiving when their form dips. I don't just mean Arsenal fans. I mean football fans in general. There's a very short-term outlook to a player's ability that, you know, one week he's fantastic, the next week he's a liability. And I understand, and I think Mertesacker would probably be the first to say that his performances this season haven't been as good as they should have been. But there are reasons for it. Not excuses, but there are reasons for it. But you know, if we can bring in a good player who works well with Mertesacker and Koscielny, I think we're looking at a situation where there's plenty of football to go around for all of them, and that's what we should do.
I think you've touched on it there, but I think the real challenge is to find someone who can play with either of our centre halves, because you know, we've talked about Chambers and Mertesacker potentially being a bit of a dysfunctional partnership. It'd be great to have someone who could play alongside Mertesacker and alongside Koscielny, and that's not an easy task necessarily, but I think that would be incredibly useful to the squad if we can get someone who's comfortable with either partner.
Okay. Alright, I've got another question here somewhere. No, I don't.
Oh, yeah. A lot of questions this week.
Okay, yeah. Right, I've got one more. Maybe two more, but one more, this one. This comes from Brian, and he is at Gunnar Faithful. And he wants to know, we all know what we want to see happen in January. What do you think will happen as far as incoming transfers?
Oh,
we're getting to that time of the year. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
It's the most. I daren't predict. I don't know. I mean, I got it wrong in the summer in terms of the spend, and I hope I'll be wrong again, because I don't expect masses of business. You know, there is a small part of me that thinks we might even... I can't even say it, but we might even do very, very little at all. I think we'll probably make one signing, and it will be a centre-back of some description. And I hope... and when I say a signing, I mean a senior signing. I think a guy like Mings from Ipswich, who we've been linked with, is almost separate to the first team policy. Although he's 21, I feel like to bring him in and ask him to play regularly in the Premier League would be very, very risky. So I don't really count that among what we might do. I think we might bring in one experienced centre-back.
Squillacci, kind of.
Yeah, Silvestre figure, you know.
No, but I mean, I don't mean to be dismissive, because if you look at the signing of Squillacci at the time, he didn't work out. But look, he was coming from Sevilla, he, you know, French international, he won European trophies. In terms of the profile of the player, like, he's not the world's best, but you would have thought that he could slot in pretty well without...
No, I mean, I'm not expecting Mats Hummels to turn up by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I've mentioned Winston Reid. I think it'll just be someone who's a proven, experienced performer, and that might not be good enough for some people, but I think that's what's realistic.
Midfield signing?
I don't expect that, no.
No, neither do I. Neither do
so
I.
So what do you think will happen?
I think we might get Mings, maybe.
And that would be it? Does that concern you? Because Tyrone Mings has played predominantly as a left-back. It's a bit of a Callum Chambers situation where people say, oh, he could be a good centre-half, but there's not really any evidence of it as yet.
Yeah. I mean, it would concern me.
But not surprise you.
Not surprise me. I mean, it's not what we want to happen. It's what we think will happen.
Yeah.
But, I really think that this January, and I think the manager must be looking at it now, and realizing that this January is almost make or break in a way, because he's got the cushion of January to make signings that will help the team have a good second part of the season to the point where he can keep his job.
And he bought an international centre-back and Sami Khedira, Do you think that would buy him some time? Like, do you think that would take the heat off him until the end of the season?
Yeah, again, though, it dependent on results.
Yeah.
You know, if he can't get those players to play, or if he can't get those the system that he wants to function, then no. So, yeah, I mean, that is the... He's got to do both of those things. Buy well in January and get the team performing.
Because ultimately none of these discussions would be happening if we were having a good season.
Correct.
It always comes back to that, doesn't it?
Mm. Go on, one more question from you, if you've got one.
All right, this is from Red Action. And they ask, was Saturday the worst Invincibles day ever?
Was it the...
worst Invincibles day ever?
Oh, does that mean the day that nobody else can...
I guess so. I guess it's replacing St. Totteringham's day. You know, it's one of those.
Well, you know what? I enjoyed that early part of the Saturday primarily because the wank fest over Chelsea going, what was it, 14 games unbeaten?
Something like that.
14 games, and people are talking about them being the Invincibles. I mean, it was just such a load of old shit that it was delightful to see it fall flat on its arse.
Were you never worried that they could do it?
Sure, a little bit. You know, you're always a little bit worried, but... it just seemed premature. Like, if they get to, you know, 25 games, then you go, okay, look, they're really doing something here.
Yeah.
But other teams have had cracking starts to the season without losing a game. I think United went 20-odd games one year without losing a game. And just this, I don't know what it is about Mourinho and the hold he has over certain sections of the media that he can't do anything wrong at all, or they think that everything he does is kind of like he's got a Midas touch, you know?
And to
see
fair.
Him after the game, you know, complaining about time wasting and all that kind of stuff, what a ridiculously hypocritical cuntbag he is. He really is. So for him to lose that game and to be fucked off about it, because you know he's fucked off when he's complaining, that was fantastic. So I take no pleasure in what happened beyond 3 o'clock on Saturday, but up to 3 o'clock, I thought it was fucking excellent. Yeah.
I agree. I think, you know, and I was mightily relieved, I have to say, because considering that they've been to the Etihad, you know, they've been to Anfield, they've been to Old Trafford, I'd be lying if I said, you know, I didn't think they could do it. I thought maybe they could. And to see them come unstuck was a relief and a delight.
Mm.
And it was a media thing primarily. You know, it's not like, you know, Arsene Wenger went out and said, I think we can do it before we did. I don't think Mourinho or any of his players were doing that. It was something that was really drummed up by the papers, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know? Well, wasn't there a front page of the Telegraph last weekend? And they you know, who did they beat last weekend? Some pack of cons that fucking they should be beating.
Oh, Spurs.
Yeah, exactly then, a pack of cons. And, you know, there's a front page on the Telegraph saying Invincible. What the fuck? Come on.
I know.
You know,
somewhat
and I know
premature.
That... Yeah, premature. Right, I've got one very final question, very quick one. Got to find out who it's from here. It is from... for fuck's sake, we're bad with our question thing here, aren't
we? Yeah, we've not been hot on it today.
I can't find it. Okay, it comes from Mongo Slade.
Of course it does.
He wants to know, do you like owls?
I love owls. Haven't we done... This is a thing, isn't it? I really like owls.
Have we done this already?
Didn't we talk about a composite animal and I wanted a bit of an owl in it?
Oh, maybe, yeah.
And you said owls creep you out, the way their heads spin round.
Yeah, they're evil.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But I really like them.
Okay.
What about this one? We'll just have this quickly.
Go on.
It's from Martin Robertson. Do you think chocolate bars have gotten smaller, or is it just that our hands have grown bigger?
I don't know that my hands have grown much bigger in the last 22, 23 years.
Really? They're not like your ears or your nose that just can carry on growing?
That would be amazing.
Stopped,
imagine if your hands just kept growing and you were left with these great big, like...
Shovel things.
Yeah, that would be... Yeah. But I suspect that chocolate bars have gotten slightly smaller down the years.
It's almost a philosophical question, isn't it?
Yeah. What's your favourite chocolate bar?
I like a Snickers.
Yeah, good classic, that.
What about you?
I don't tend to eat them very much anymore, but I was always very, very partial to cream egg. Oh, I know it's not necessarily a chocolate bar, but...
How do you eat yours?
I'd kind of nibble off the top and then nibble around it, and I slurp out some of the inner jism, and then...
So we can just clip that little passage, by the way, and turn it into some erotic audio fiction.
And then when there's about a third or a half of the cream egg left, I just, like, throw it in there and let it melt away.
There you go. That's like all our troubles. Like
yes.
All our troubles.
All right, well, look, we're going to look ahead to the Newcastle game and review the Galatasaray game on the Arscast on Friday. We'll be back next Monday with an action-packed Arscast Extra. It'll be fun.
Bye, everyone. It'll be great fun. I can't wait. I'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.